Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Oshman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org.
This is Judaism Unbound, episode 239, Isaac Unbound. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rothberg.
And today we are taking a one-week break from the series that we're in the midst of, looking at the impact of feminism on Judaism, to learn about a new book that has just come out. Before we jump into what that book is, I just want to mention that with the High Holidays coming up, this is a time of year when Jewish organizations often make a fundraising appeal, and we're no different. We're really trying to put out a tremendous amount of Jewish ideas and thinking and possibilities. And the only way that we're able to do that is through the support of the people who are using what we're putting out there. We don't want to put anything or almost anything behind a paywall. We'd much rather put out everything for free and then ask people if you've been enjoying it, if it's been meaningful to you, to understand that it does cost money to do it and to consider making a donation. We often just put out the idea that if everybody just gave $1 for every hour of content that they consume or that they participate in, that would be really good. We would be really in good shape as a nonprofit organization. We love that idea because maybe it's a new way of funding a Jewish organization in a digital world. Maybe we don't need to charge thousands of dollars of membership. We can just ask people to give $1 for every hour that they're with us. And we have so many thousands of people that are using what we're putting out there that that would actually amount to a very well-funded organization. Now, so far, a lot of people are listening to Judaism Unbound and they're not donating that dollar. And that's fine. We understand that not everybody's able to, or sometimes you forget between when you listen to the podcast and when you make it to your computer, or there's too many steps involved. So we want to put the idea out there that if you're the kind of person who often makes generous contributions to Jewish organizations, if you're somebody who pays thousands of dollars for synagogue dues, but you really find that Judaism Unbound or Jewish Live is really something that you're spending a lot more hours than that on, then maybe you'll consider even a larger donation, not thousands of dollars unless you'd like to and you have that, but at least maybe $180 or something like that. Those kinds of contributions really go a long way in terms of what we're doing here in the new digital wilderness that we're all living in. So at this time, with the High Holidays coming up, if you're in the mindset of making contributions to Jewish organizations and to other organizations at this time of the new year, then we'd certainly like to put out the request that you consider giving a donation to Judaism Unbound. And the way you can do that is simple. Just go to www.judaismunbound.com/donate, and we're really grateful. Now, turning to the subject of today's conversation, it really also has to do with the High Holidays. Some people know, and some people don't know, it's no shame either way, that the Torah reading traditionally on the second day of Rosh Hashanah is the binding of Isaac, the story of the binding of Isaac, or the near sacrifice of Isaac. It's, in my opinion, kind of a terrifying story, a horrifying story in which God asks Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac to bring him as a burnt offering. And Abraham seemingly agrees to do it. And just at the moment before Abraham is about to slaughter Isaac, an angel calls out to him and says, "Don't lay a hand on the boy." And Abraham frees Isaac, and then he catches his eye that there's a ram caught in a thicket, and he sacrifices that ram in the place of Isaac. And there's so many interpretations of this story, ranging from perhaps God wanted Abraham to say no, or maybe the story is really about how animal sacrifices started, that they took the place of human sacrifice. There's so many possibilities, and there's so many questions about why this story is traditionally read on Rosh Hashanah. And it's fortuitous timing that a book has just come out by our guest today, Aaron Kohler. The book is called Unbinding Isaac, The Significance of the Akedah for Modern Jewish Thought. Akedah is the Hebrew word for binding. And before we jump into the conversation, I just want to note that our guest today, Aaron Kohler, has helped us develop a project called the Akedah Project, which you can find at www.akedahproject.com. That's A-K-E-D-A-H project.com. Or you can find it at jewishlive.org/Isaac. And you can see over 30 short videos by a wide range of thinkers and artists and scholars and people who themselves have had an experience similar to feeling sacrificed by a parent or being asked to sacrifice a child. There's over 30 different perspectives on this story on that page. And it's something that we at Judaism Unbound and Jewish Live have put together, along with our partners, 929 English, which is a website that explores one chapter of the Bible every day. Bina, the Jewish Movement for Social Change, which is known for running a secular yeshiva in Israel. And the Ashman Family JCC, which we've worked with for a long time. And we're really excited to have launched this project just in time for the High Holidays so that people can really explore this story in depth. And our guest today helped us put it together as well. Aaron Kohler is professor of Near Eastern Studies and chair of the Department of Jewish Studies at Yeshiva University, where he studies the ancient world of the Eastern Mediterranean and Near East, especially material culture, language, and intellectual history. In addition to Unbinding Isaac, he is the author of a book about the Book of Esther from the Purim story called Esther in Ancient Jewish Thought. We are really excited to explore this book, and we're really excited to explore the story of the Binding of Isaac as we prepare for the High Holidays. Aaron Kohler, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
So let's start by talking a little bit about, well, if you could start by just giving us a capsule summary of the story of the Binding of Isaac in its significant parts. In other words, when we talk about the role of this story in modern Jewish thought and in modern thought in general, give us a sense a little bit of the story and where the parts are that are important. And also, I'd love to hear how you embarked on this project. What was it that you were trying to do with this book?
So the story itself is found in Genesis 22. It's an incredibly short story. The whole thing is 19 verses long. It's both the sort of capstone of Abraham's life, which puts it in a climactic position literarily. In other words, even if we didn't get to the content of it, I think anyone reading the book of Genesis would realize that whatever story is here would probably be significant, because after this, Sarah dies, Isaac gets married, he becomes the main character. So this is, it's an important story in terms of its position. The story itself focuses on Abraham. We're told at the beginning that this is a test, a trial of Abraham from God. And God says, go take your son, your only son, the one whom you love, Isaac, and go offer him up on an altar in a place that I'll show you. And Abraham walks for 3 days. He gets to a mountain. He binds Isaac. And the word used for binding there is la'akod, which is actually a pretty rare word, but that gives us the noun akedah. So it literally means binding in Hebrew. And just as he's about to slaughter his one and only remaining son, an angel calls from heaven and says, Abraham, stop, don't touch the boy. There's a sort of pause. And then the angel speaks again and says, now I know that you fear God. You didn't withhold your son from God. Abraham lifts up his eyes and sees that there's a ram caught by its horns in the thicket on the mountaintop. So he goes, takes the ram, offers that as a sacrifice. And then God sort of reiterates some promises that he had given before about the descendants of Abraham and how they'll be numerous and successful. And that's basically the story. We're then told that Abraham goes home, not told anything about Isaac, which readers have noted forever. It just sort of drops out of the story. And then the scene shifts and we hear about the birth of some grand nieces and nephews to Abraham far away, and then move on to other episodes. So that's the story in a nutshell. I think it looms large for a lot of reasons in Jewish thought. It's placed in central spots in Jewish practice. It's the Torah reading for the second day of Rosh Hashanah. So, you know, there are, I don't know what percentage, but many, many Jews who only come to synagogue on Rosh Hashanah. And if they're going to hear something in the Torah, that's what they're going to be hearing. It's actually in the Siddur. It's in a sort of traditional prayer book printed in the morning service every single day to be recited. I don't know how many people actually do that, but it's there printed to be recited every morning as part of like the morning rituals. My own work here, so I had actually first started working on this as an example of biblical interpretation. I was teaching a year-long course on Jewish biblical interpretation, and this is just such a rich text in terms of the way it's been read and interpreted over the course of literally millennia that I thought, this is great. You know, we started with Dead Sea Scrolls. Actually started with some inner biblical interpretation, but Dead Sea Scrolls, pay attention to it. There's tons in rabbinic literature, in all the Second Temple books, then the medieval commentators and modern commentators. So it was a lot of rich material, and that got me just sort of noticing certain things that I thought were interesting. But I didn't start working on it as a book project until I realized just how high the stakes were in terms of modern thought and even public policy when this story is invoked. There was an ad that a sort of weird group took out before Elie Wiesel passed away. So he was like the star of the ad. And he says, you know, the Jews repudiated child sacrifice millennia ago. And this is the story of the binding of Isaac, tells us that we don't sacrifice our children. But Hamas still hasn't learned that lesson. You know, we can talk about this a little bit more, but one interpretation of the Akedah is in fact a rejection of child sacrifice. I should say that's far from repudiating in practice child sacrifice. And as even the text is saying, don't do it, it doesn't mean Jews didn't do it. And actually there's lots of evidence from within the Bible that Jews did do child sacrifice. But then, of course, the politics of that were just like so incendiary. It was actually amazing. And I was like, wow, like, who would have thought the biblical stories mattered so much? You know, we sort of like, we go, we read, you know, but it really hadn't occurred to me that a story could actually mean so much and be deployed in such powerful ways for, you know, one cause or another. You know, a lot of the work that I do consciously doesn't matter. You know, like those of us who work in philology are like, you know, we think it's worth knowing what texts mean, but like, we're not going to pretend that this matters to the world. And this is like, yeah, this actually might matter. So it might be worth spending some more time on this.
In the book, really, it seems that Kierkegaard is the fulcrum around which a lot of this shift takes place. I'm wondering if you could give us a little bit of a sense of how was the Akedah, the Binding of Isaac, seen by Jewish interpreters before Kierkegaard, and did they think it mattered back then? I mean, like, how important was the story back then for any kind of policy or any kind of other reasons that the Jews or Christians, I suppose, might have been thinking about this story? And then basically when Kierkegaard comes in, why is that so significant? What does he do that's such a change?
I think it's important to say, this is, I'm channeling something that Israeli philosopher Avi Sagi wrote. Said, until the 20th century, no Jewish thinkers took the Akedah and made it the cornerstone of religious life. It was an important story, but it was not a story that if you said, like, you know, let's summarize Judaism in one line, where do we start? What story is most important? You'd get things like the Exodus, the revelation at Sinai. The Akedah would come up if I asked for examples of faith, relationships of the patriarchs with God, all sorts of different things, but it was not the cornerstone of Judaism. Now, it wasn't a popular story. We can say that with a lot of certainty, both because people say so. This is maybe not the most obvious place to get information about what Jews thought. But St. Augustine, who lives in the 4th century in North Africa, says that the story of the Akedah is so famous that like it just pops into your head all the time. Like no one has to mention it. It just like shows up in your head because it's just all around you. Now that in Jewish society is empirically true because we see it in mosaics on synagogue floors, Beit Alpha, at Sepphoris, a couple others. We see it on wall paintings in synagogues in Dura Europis, off in Syria. And the Akedah is sort of like all over the place quantitatively. Like we do see it. Now, what did it mean to people when it is on the floor of the synagogue? That's much harder to say. It's clear that a Jew who walked into a synagogue in Sepphoris would literally walk into the Akedah. Like they would walk in and like see it on the floor. And the assumption is that the seating was like around these beautiful mosaics on the floor, although maybe they were just sitting on top of them. That happens too. But they would see it. They would be confronted by it. But what did it mean is a much harder question. You know, we say that a picture is worth 1,000 words, But that's only true in some contexts. If you actually want to teach someone something, you really do need the words. I'll give you one text which sort of occurs in a bunch of different contexts that I think is really interesting. There's a number of texts that say, that sort of frame the story not as a trial of Abraham, but as a trial of Isaac. They introduce the story with a little anecdote that's not found in the Bible. And it goes like this. It goes, you know, Abraham had two children, Ishmael and Isaac. And the two of them were arguing one day. Ishmael said, I'm the fitting heir to father. I'm the oldest one. And Isaac says, yeah, I mean, you're older, but like your mom is my mom's maidservant, which is not a nice thing to say. And Ishmael says, all right, fair. Maybe by blood, you have a better claim to be the heir. But by merit, my claim is much better. I was circumcised at the age of 13 years. I demonstrated my faith by going along with that. You were circumcised at the age of 8 days. You had nothing to do with that. So you've actually never demonstrated any faith of your own at all. You're just sort of an adjunct to dad's faith. And Isaac says, well, I wish that I would be called upon to demonstrate my faith in some way. I would be willing to do anything. And the Midrash says, then comes the Akedah. So God said, okay, Abraham, take your son. So this is really fascinating for a couple of reasons. First of all, as I said, it sort of shifts the focus from Abraham to Isaac. And second of all, I suspect that this relates to Jews' own thinking about their own merit as well. So this is all pre-Islamic. So Ishmael can't be a stand-in for the Muslims. But the idea that Abraham has two children who are fighting over who's fit to be the heir of Abraham, that's plausibly sort of a code for Jews and Christians. And the first few centuries of the Common Era, Christians have tons of martyrdom stories because it was illegal and the Romans would martyr you if you declared that you were a follower of Jesus Christ. The Jews did not have tons of martyrdom stories. They do loom large. There are martyrdom stories in rabbinic Judaism. But when you think about it, you have this like very famous poem, Midrash, of the 10 martyrs. And the 10 martyrs are drawn from like 300 years of Jewish history. So like 10 martyrs over the course of 300 years is like, look, it's too much. I mean, I don't want to excuse anything. But statistically, sort of, that's not a lot. Whereas the Christians, like, there are martyrs like every year, like multiple martyrs, because anyone who declared their faith in Jesus was crucified by the Romans. So I actually suspect that the dynamic behind that Midrash is inter-religious polemics, where you could imagine a Christian saying, or probably more realistically, a Jew imagining a Christian saying, yeah, we're both children of Abraham, sure. But you have never had to do anything to demonstrate your faith. You're sitting pretty, you live in Palestine, it's true, you know, the temple was destroyed, but like, you guys picked that fight, so you're suffering the consequences. But, now you live in the Galilee, you're writing the Mishnah, you're making Midrash, you're composing the Talmud, like your life is pretty good. But we Christians, we literally die for our faith. And that's a troubling argument for a Jew by the following logic. Something that's really worthwhile is worth sacrificing for. Therefore, if someone sacrifices for something, it must be really worthwhile. So if people are dying for, that's not actually good logic. Like if you're a logician, you'd be like, no, that's not right. That's a fallacy, which is true. But I think there's a lot of emotional power to it. So if you're a Jew, you're like, well, the Christians are literally dying for their faith. Their faith must be worthwhile. We're not actually dying for our faith. Like, how do we demonstrate our faith? And the Akedah is sort of framed as like, well, here's the proof. When confronted with the demand to offer himself on the altar, Isaac stepped up unhesitatingly, like full willing participant in that story. This is, I think, one example of where the Akedah may have been meaningful to Jews of antiquity. They look at the story and they say, like, well, here's our story of willingness to martyr ourselves. It's not a martyrdom story, and we're, again, happy not to die on the cross. But that shouldn't mean that we're any less willing to die for our faith if we need to.
That part of your book, I really, you used a phrase, maybe you could help me capture it, of like, it was almost like whose martyrdom is bigger, like who's, there was like a martyr, you talk about it in your book, like it's like a martyrdom contest that's clearly happening between different groups, which it just felt so fascinating to think about it through that lens, where like, it's a point for your worldview, for your tradition, for your religious outlook, whatever we're going to call it, to have that example of sacrifice. I think that's a really fascinating thing. And what I want to go to from the place that the story looms large, that it matters, to use your terminology, is I want to think about like how it matters and to who, and I want to turn, and this is a risky thing to say, to Kierkegaard, because of how you use that. Now, to listeners, hello out there. I feel like Soren Kierkegaard is not necessarily like the sexy topic that everybody is like ready to be like, oh yeah, I'm going to tune in to my podcast about Kierkegaard and that's going to be stimulating today. But I want to tell you, like, this is going to be fun. It really is. You have to trust me. But so let's go to Kierkegaard. Talk us through what his argument is about this story and how people have sort of been influenced by that argument around the Binding of Isaac, and why that in turn matters, in addition to the story itself mattering.
Kierkegaard, with or without the story of the Binding of Isaac, was sort of fixated on two issues that are really important for him in the early 19th century and are still super important for us in the 21st century. One, how to figure out the place of an individual in a big corporate world. I don't mean corporate in the you know, sense of corporations, but we're all like the corporate entities of like Americans or big group identities that swallow up individuals to a large extent. So how do we figure out like where we fit as individuals in these like big movements? And two, how does faith interact with modernity? And in particular, or to be even more specific about it, he was worried about the individual being lost in like a sea of relationships. Like I am, I'll talk about myself for a second. So I teach, I wrote a book, I am married, and that's a large part of like how I think about the world. I'm a parent. I spend a lot of time thinking about myself as a parent. And Kierkegaard was really troubled by the idea that the sum total of me is all those relationships. Is there a me left in the middle there? Or am I just reducible to like all these relationships? So that was the individual part. And the faith part, the phrase that I think I coined, although I don't know, maybe I got it from somewhere else, is martyr envy.
Martyr envy, yeah. That's what it was. Not whose martyrdom is bigger.
Well, that's exactly the idea, right? But this idea that like somehow, you know, you want to be a martyr in order to show just how powerful your faith is. Kierkegaard seems to have that also, because he's like, my life as a Christian is easy. Like, you know, no one's asking me to do anything. I'm not being crucified for my faith. I'm sitting here in Copenhagen. He inherited money. He like doesn't have to work. Like, that's a Christian. He's like, he's looking back, not only at Jesus, but like all the church fathers and all the martyrs from antiquity, the saints who like spend years out in the desert trying to find true faith. And he's like, that seems like faith. Like, I don't know what I'm doing exactly, but it's not the same religion. So he brings these both to bear on the story of the Binding of Isaac. And he's like, this is the story that answers my two questions. Here's the story where we find out that there are all these universal values, ethics, that are rightfully guiding our life most of the time. A good father ought not to kill his innocent child. So like that's a general principle, and Abraham is generally a good father, and Abraham loves Isaac, and like that's great because Abraham's a regular person like the rest of us. But what the story gives Kierkegaard is an example of what happens when faith clashes with these universal ethics. Because here's this like crazy episode where God comes to Abraham and says, you're generally a good person. You're ethical, you're moral, you're a good father, you're a good husband, you've been teaching people all the right things. It's all fantastic. However, I'm now going to ask you to do something that you cannot understand. I'm going to ask you to take your son and offer him as a sacrifice on the altar. And Kierkegaard says, so what we have here is what I've actually been looking for in life. It's a question of what to do when faith conflicts with ethics. Abraham puts ethics aside for the sake of his faith. So the modern world comes with all these ethical norms, like you have to be a good citizen, you have to be a good spouse, you have to be a good parent. And this is actually now societal norms. I mean, part of, I don't know much about the legal landscape of early 19th century Denmark, I suspect that there weren't a lot of laws about domestic abuse or child abuse, but actually, you know, those kinds of laws are where the modern state gets involved in policing our most intimate relationships. Right? So these things used to be exempt from societal norms because, okay, it's between the wife and the husband, and you know, they have whatever relationship they want. Now, obviously, you know, I think from our perspective, this is a major victory of modernity that, you know, no, it's not up to a couple to negotiate whether or not he beats her. Like, society stepped in and said, like, that's not acceptable no matter what. But what that actually means, and what troubled Kierkegaard to some extent, is that that means that the state has actually taken over all of our intimate relationships. Like, where is the intimacy? Where is the personal nature of life when the state has commandeered what it means to be a spouse, what it means to be a parent, what it means to be an employee? All these things are now dysfunctions of what it means to be a good citizen. Everything's been reduced to being a citizen of Denmark. So it's like, well, here's a story that says that sometimes faith might actually ask you to put that all aside. And for your faith, you have to suspend the ethical. And the story gives Kierkegaard a way of thinking about what it means to be a modern Christian. So he's very much opposed to the idea that Christianity is going to be just subsumed under modernity.
So then, given that Kierkegaard has sort of established this approach in certain ways, how do people run with that, whether that's thinkers, but also in addition to, like, you know, philosophers and folks relating to big questions of how the world is, of faith, morality. In addition to them, also, how do just, like, people understand this as applied to the Akedah too?
The truth is that for most of the 19th century, no one cared about Kierkegaard. He said these things, and you know, he wrote in Danish. People don't read Danish, with all due respect to all the Danish listeners out there. And he was untranslated for decades after his death. But by the time you get to the early 20th century, the questions that he was really obsessed with 100 years earlier have become like the central questions that people are struggling with. You know, world wars. And world war is like, where is the individual if we can just send tens of millions of soldiers out to the front to like die in a trench without any regard for like who they are? They're not anyone. They're literally cannon fodder. So, you know, that's a dramatic example, but it's really symptomatic of what was, I think, occupying a lot of people 100 years ago. It was a certain new realization that individual lives just didn't seem to matter anymore because they've been swallowed up by these huge movements. And that's, you know, what Kierkegaard had been worried about a century earlier. So by the time we get to the early 20th century, Kierkegaard is like rediscovered. Everyone's reading Kierkegaard. But these the issue of the individual's role in society seems to have been troubling poets, artists, like everyone is worried about this.
I will note that we actually have a lot of listeners in Denmark, so we're really excited to be able to talk about a Danish philosopher.
I just looked it up. It's our 11th most populous download hub. So 11th, all you Danes out there, you're number 11. If you wanna rise in the rankings, just tell your friends about us.
So on that score, though, so how does Kierkegaard, how does he end up playing into Jewish thought, given that he's a Christian, he's Danish, a lot of Jews don't speak Danish other than our listeners. So how does it all happen? And is the Jewish response specifically to Kierkegaard, or is it sort of a response to kind of other things that are in the air that may be traced to Kierkegaard? You know, how does Jewish thought start to shift on the Akedah?
You know, there's this whole group of Jewish intellectuals who like went to graduate school in philosophy in like the 1920s and 30s. And the two that play a big role in my book are Yeshayahu Leibovitch, who went to Israel and became a sort of a public intellectual gadfly in Israeli society, and Joseph Ber Soloveitchik, who moved to the States and became first a rabbi in Boston, and then incredibly influential head of the rabbinical school at Yeshiva University, where he became the single most influential rabbi in the modern Orthodox community in the 20th century. And the two of them both sort of took Kierkegaard and ran with it. And it's, you know, worth noticing that those two are Orthodox. So, you know, the sort of daily rituals of Jewish law, the daily halakha, are shaping everything about their lives and how they think about Judaism. These issues don't always live comfortably with the values of modern society. So Rabbi Soloveitchik here and Professor Leibovich in Israel took the Akedah and like literally made it a cornerstone of Jewish thought for the modern age. Neither of them was particularly historically sophisticated. So neither of them is like, well, in the 20th century, this is what we need to do, but it's different from the Middle Ages. They both sort of argue that this is just Judaism, like in a sort of ahistorical sense. But they both take the Akedah and they say, like, this is what it means to be a religious person. A religious person is always prepared to put aside societal values for the demands of their religion. Leibovich says, like, let's think about the character of Abraham. Abraham, as we know, has in the past argued with God, right? A very famous story at Sodom and Gomorrah, where God comes down and says, Abraham, listen, I'm going to go check out the city of Sodom. I hear bad things are happening, and if so, I'm going to have to figure out what to do. And Abraham says, whoa, before you go, let's talk about the ethics of how God ought to punish a city. If there are 50 righteous people in the city, you wouldn't wipe out the city, right? And God says, no, you're right, I shouldn't. Okay, and they sort of barter it down until Abraham gets God to concede that if there are even 10 righteous people in a city, he would not destroy the city. And then God goes and discovers that there are not 10 righteous people in the city, so he's free to destroy the city. So, you know, it turns out to have been all for naught. But Abraham did step up and argue that God is bound by ethics. And these are like rousing lines. Like, you're the judge of the whole world. How could you not execute justice? And Leibovich says that is not a high point of Abraham's religious life. That is the low point. That is where he went off the rails and showed that he actually does not understand what God is. Because it's not true that God is bound by ethics. Religion in general, and God in particular, are aethical. Like, they're just outside of ethics. It's not necessarily unethical, but they have nothing to do with ethics. So God, it's true, sort of indulged Abraham in this conversation, but actually God was sitting there saying, like, wow, Abraham really doesn't get it. Abraham thinks that I, God, am bound by ethics. It's a sort of astounding that he hasn't understood yet that that's not true. So at some point, I'm going to have to teach him a lesson. That lesson comes in the Akedah, and Leibovich is reading. God comes to Abraham and says, here, let me give you a test. Do something horribly unethical. Are you prepared to follow me even to the realm of the unethical? And now God's sort of forcing Abraham to decide, was I only following God because God was ethical? Or was I following God for God's sake? And if God turns out to be unethical, I will forsake ethics and go with God. And Leibovich says, this is the cornerstone of religion. Right? So this is like sort of astonishing. This is what religion is all about. If you are religious because you think it makes you a good person, Leibovich says, you're an idolater. You're not actually worshiping God. You found a good way of getting to be a good person, and it's convenient. So you're like, oh, okay, I'm going to sort of grab onto the coattails of this religion thing. That turns out to be a good way of doing good stuff. So, I mean, I think you see the not just philosophical stakes, but the public policy stakes in statements like that. And I should say that there were lots of Jewish leaders who read Kierkegaard in the 20th century and like recoiled, blasted, like, this is absolutely un-Jewish. I think, for example, of Milton Steinberg, who's probably best known for the novel As a Driven Leaf, but was a very important, prominent Reform rabbi in the mid-20th century, who has a little essay on Kierkegaard and Judaism. And he says, Judaism would never ask its practitioners to abandon ethics for faith. On the contrary, God is nothing if not ethical. So it's not that Jewish society overall sort of looked at Kierkegaard and said, like, oh, this is great, this is where we're going to go. There were lots of different voices in the 20th century as well. But this particular perspective that religion did not have to agree with ethics and actually might lead people away from ethics, and that was okay, that was legitimated by this reading of the Akedah, that becomes very influential in the 20th century. And that's really what I'm trying to argue against in the book.
I mean, I think it's a really fascinating read on the story. Like, I've always thought, like, well, why all of a sudden is there this test of Abraham, you know, out of the blue? And it actually, I don't like it, but it actually makes sense to say, you know, well, the reason that this test was needed is because, you know, God wanted to make sure that Abraham's not going to keep doing that thing where he's, you know, kind of bargaining or trying to get God to talk God out of the things that God wants to do.
Right. And I love that point also, like, I think educationally, you know, I'm always scared when I talk about Leibovich because it's actually like it makes so much sense.
Yeah.
Like it's bad, it's evil. But I'm going to say things, it's going to sound attractive. I'm going to tell you it's bad. But in the book, I do spend a little bit of time trying to explain why I think it's bad, despite being sort of an attractive literary reader.
Yeah, it's coherent. I mean, the thing that that I wanted to follow up a little bit, though, on is that, you know, as part of this project that you are working on with us on putting together all these talks on the Akeda, which has just launched the other day, one of the ones that I got, that gave me a perspective that I hadn't thought about before was Reuven Kimmelman, who was talking about how, in a sense, there's a test of God in the Akedah as well, because part of the covenant that God has made with Abraham is that he should have a great nation should come from him. He's going to have all these descendants. And if he kills Isaac, then by definition, and of course, you can talk it out, you know, you can say, oh, we'll have another kid or whatever. But functionally, in terms of how the story is set up, that by definition, if he kills Isaac, he is essentially sacrificing his bargain. And I used to teach contracts, you know, in law school. Like there's something very, so it's beyond a test of faith. It's a weird sort of test that says if Abraham actually passes the test of faith, he can only do so by undercutting the bargain that he made in order to have that faith in the first place, meaning he ends up with absolutely no reward. The covenant is then breached and worthless. And it kind of, I don't know, it kind of at that point starts to feel a bit like a Job story where, you know, really it's just, and in a sense that the only way that the story can work out, which I guess is what it does, is that Abraham goes up to the moment and he indicates that he would do that. And then, you know, the whole thing gets called off. So, but if you actually sort of think about what's being asked here, it's not only horrifying, but it's also a fundamental breach of all the premises of the relationship. And in some ways, I think that that's where at least I, as a modern, come at this and say, you know, well, I guess I am the kind of Jew that Leibovitch was against, right? In the sense of saying, like, if the whole thing doesn't turn out to make us better, to make the world a better place, then yeah, I'm probably not interested in it, right? I mean, I'm not interested in Judaism or religion just for the sake of some kind of demonstration of faith to God. It has to feel, and maybe this is a very modern perspective, it has to feel like something good is going to come of it.
That's, I think, what makes this a modern reading, and exactly what you said. I think pre-modern people, they didn't have the answers to all the questions, but they fundamentally believed that religion and goodness were like on the same team. Like being a good person, being religious, like these are, you know, basically these are going to agree. And yeah, there's problems. You know, there's the genocide of Amalek that's mandated in the Torah. Like this is a problem. But the fact that it's a problem is only a problem because basically we assume that the Torah is good. Like that religion is working on the side of good in the world. This idea that Kierkegaard, you know, I'll lay it on his shoulders for introducing this, that actually religion might not be on the side of good. It's not, Kierkegaard doesn't think it's on the side of bad. He just thinks it's like not on the good team. It's like outside of the good. So that it really is a modern idea. And, you know, I think that's where it gets very dangerous. Like if religion can actually mandate things that are explicitly evil, right? I mean, the whole point is like Abraham is a murderer by all standards. I mean, he happens not to be, but like he's prepared to be a murderer by all standards. There's no apology for that. And if the cops were there and they arrested him, he would have no defense. And Kierkegaard says this explicitly. Like he can't go to court and say faith because that's against the rules of faith and it's against the rules of ethics. Like you can't mix the two realms and invoke faith as a legal defense. So he would be arrested and he would be, you know, convicted of murder if he did this. And he would say nothing at all in his defense. But that really is a modern idea that religion might actually not be making the world a better place. Obviously, not all modern people have taken that, but that idea is in fact modern. Let me mention two texts that I think are really interesting for the idea that you threw out there. One ancient, one modern. In the Dead Sea Scrolls, there is a text which has the sexy name of 4Q225, where the story of the Akedah is retold. And in that text, the test is instigated by bad angels.
It's Jubilees. Okay, so we've talked about Jubilees on this show before, and I'm not gonna let this go. So I've been on a Jubilees spree, and I appreciate what you were doing from the bottom of my heart, which is you were trying to make it accessible and not garble it up with, but like we've specifically talked about this book, and so I want a name. That this is Jubilees. It's an alt take on the Binding of Isaac. It is tied to, of all things, Passover. We don't have to go into that if you don't want to, but I want to center that there's this demon figure, Mastema, who instigates the thing. Right. Back to you, Aaron.
Oh, amazing. Okay, so I can assume more on the part of listeners than I thought I could. So 4Q225 is not actually a copy of Jubilees, but it's like somehow related literarily to Jubilees. Exactly. And Mastema instigates the trial, as you said, very much, Dan, like you said, like very much like in the story of Job, and like the story obviously is sort of influenced by the Job story. Mastema comes and says, Abraham's only faithful to you because you've been good to him. You gave him a son, take away the son, and see what happens then. And the point that I wanted to mention is that in that text, there are good angels who are up in heaven looking down at the Akedah unfolding, and they start to cry. And they say, well, this is terrible. The whole covenant is lost because we're now in a bind. Either Abraham will follow through on the sacrifice of Isaac, and then covenant's lost because Isaac's dead. Or Abraham won't follow through on the sacrifice of Isaac, and then the covenant's lost because Abraham has proved that he's not as faithful as we thought he was. And it's literally a deus ex machina, right? It can only be stopped because God steps in and says, actually, I'm going to save the day here, sends an angel to stop the Akedah. But that point, there's a teacher of mine a long, long time ago used the phrase, the omniscient reader, to describe our problem with reading biblical texts. We all know how they end. So it's really hard to feel any tension in a story when we like know what's about to happen. This story, it's meant to be tense. And we're supposed to, early readers understood that you pause as the knife is raised in the air and appreciate the stakes here. And not only about the human life that's on the line, that also, but the covenant that's on the line. Like there's no way out of this. This is about to end. And Abraham's 100 and whatever he is. Like, there's no more kids coming. So like this whole drama of the covenantal family is just going to end after one generation, and God has to step in and save that. So that is one text that I think is acutely aware of the problem that you're mentioning. The other one is actually Elie Wiesel, who I mentioned in a less laudatory context earlier. But Elie Wiesel, in his book on biblical figures, has an interpretation of the Akedah, which I think is quite brilliant. He says that Abraham also understood the bind that he was now in, and that God was now in. And Abraham understood that God has already promised that he's going to have offspring and a nation and so on and so forth. And so he can't actually require that Abraham sacrifice Isaac. So Abraham's like, great, you know what I'm going to do here? I'm going to play chicken with God. Because God's going to have to back down. Unless God wants to make himself a liar, he's not going to be able to allow me to go through with the sacrifice of Isaac. So let's do it. Here we go, God. And he bundles them up and he walks to the mountain and he takes out the knife and he's like, at some point you imagine Abraham like, okay, like this is actually pretty terrifying. But he was right in the end. Like God had to step in and do that. And why would Abraham do that? Well, because what he extracts from God for the first time is an oath by God's own name. God actually says, Bi Nishpati, like I now swear by myself, your heirs will grow to be a nation, they'll be successful, and so on. So in other words, Abraham has sort of cornered God into guaranteeing a future for his own people in a qualitatively more profound way than he has in the past. And that, I think, gives a whole resonance to the idea of the Akedah being what the rabbinic text is called Zechut Avot, right? The merit of the ancestors. In other words, Abraham has actually engineered it to be that. He boxed God into a corner so that God had no choice but to basically say, you win, what do you want? And Abraham says, okay, what I want is, look, I already have my one son, I'm not having more. What I want is this to stand as surety for me and for my heirs for time, from now on, that when they're in trouble, you'll think, oh, well, the Akedah, that will stand in their merit. So then I think your contract point is exactly right. Like Abraham on this reading sort of sees that he's actually in the stronger position and uses the contract to his own benefit, which really in the later Jewish thought is for the benefit of his descendants.
I want to imagine a parallel universe for a second, a parallel like Rosh Hashanah universe that I think could easily exist, but doesn't currently. Jews around the world walk into synagogue on Rosh Hashanah. You mentioned it's traditionally associated with the second day of Rosh Hashanah, this story. I actually grew up in a congregation that only did one day of Rosh Hashanah, and we read it the first day of Rosh Hashanah. So I want to name that, like, in communities that had to pick which of the two, this Akedah reading or the other one, we went with this one, because it's, like you said, it's so fascinating. But so you walk into synagogue, Rosh Hashanah, there's the Akedah story for the Torah. In this parallel universe, the companion reading is not the story of Hannah, which we currently have a companion story. The Haftorah reading that sort of corresponds to this is Hannah, who gives birth to Samuel. Well, that's actually the end of the story. Hannah, at first, is unable to bear a child, prays from the bottom of her heart deeply, sincerely, to the point that a nearby priest thinks she's drunk. And then, you know, there's a child born to her. That's a companion story. There's clear resonances between that text about a beloved son coming into the world and the challenges of coming close to sacrificing a son in this Akedah story. Okay, so there's clear resonances there. In this parallel universe, a different story is the Haftorah reading. In this parallel universe, the companion story that we read alongside Isaac and Abraham at Mount Moriah is Bat Yiftach, is the daughter of Jephthah. So this story is one that I did not know at all until I was late in college, my last year of college. And I was like doing my thesis on Jewish vows. That's what started me on this road. You mentioned an oath, a shavua. That's part of the realm of Jewish vows. And I learned about this story in the book of Judges that is the daughter of Yiftach, Yiftach being a character in the book of Judges who sort of makes a contract with God that if I win this battle, If I go to this battle with these nearby people, and if we win, I will show my appreciation to you, God, by sacrificing the first thing that comes out of my house. And what happens is, what do you think walks out of that house? His daughter. Not some animal, not some. So he has to sacrifice his daughter. Now, there's still some ambiguities here, and people interpret this text differently, but many people interpret this so that there is actually a human sacrifice in the Bible that is right there. And so my question is, A, like, what the heck, everyone? Why aren't we talking about this story in the context of this other one, which brings up all these tensions of child sacrifice? I was taught growing up, the fact that the angel stopped, that's really the core message here. I think that's great, by the way. That's a good lesson to come away that we don't want to sacrifice children. But like, clearly the message here was that in ancient Israel, we don't do child sacrifice. We don't do that. But we have this other text where we do. My question in this parallel universe, or in our current universe, because this text still exists, like, how do we understand this text and what it's like telling us at the end of the day? Because there's clear questions at play here about whether it was even a clear fact to Abraham or anybody else that killing his son would be wrong. Like, there, it seems that there were other moments where you were supposed to kill your child. So, like, I'm flurrying out a rant of, like, discontent, but, like, help me out. What do we gain from looking at this story on Rosh Hashanah? What might we gain if we sort of paired it with this other, even more tense story of child sacrifice?
Yeah, so that's great. So two things. So one is, if you ask Jephthah, why are you prepared to offer your daughter as a sacrifice? He would say, well, I have to. I vowed, and I'm bound by my vow. Now, we could argue whether legalistically that's true or not, but the point is, he has a rational explanation for why he thinks he has to go through it. It doesn't ask him to step outside of ethics and universal norms to do something for faith. That's a dilemma within the realm of ethics. Like, that's just a reasonable this world question to ask. Is the value of fulfilling my vow more important than the value of not offering my daughter as a sacrifice? So Kierkegaard is like, only Abraham can't answer the question, why am I doing this? He's the only one who has to say, like, just faith and no more. So I think you're absolutely right. Like, clearly there's a lot of reasons to put these stories together. Kierkegaard is actually at pains to distinguish the stories. Your sort of central question about child sacrifice. So, you know, this is a hard truth. Like, the prophets keep blasting the Israelites for offering their children as sacrifices. Like, Jeremiah is upset about it. Ezekiel is upset about it. They're like, why are you offering children as sacrifices? God does not want child sacrifice. So that makes it very clear that there was child sacrifice in ancient Israel. That obviously has to have happened in order for it to be the target of the prophet's arguments. I think that actually strengthens what you heard as a kid about the point of the Akedah. It does make it clear that the Akedah was not totally effective as an educational text in getting rid of child sacrifice. But it heightens the stakes as to why the Torah had to teach a story that repudiates child sacrifice. Like, this actually happened, not only outside of Israel, but in Israel. Like, people actually offer their Torah sacrifices. There is, we go back to this ethical problem of like saying compelling things that are horrible. I think religiously speaking, sacrifices in general have a particular problem of it's never quite clear how sincere they are. Right? So if I'm a believing person, I'm a farmer, a shepherd in ancient Israel, and I'm good. Every spring I bring the first wheat and the first sheep to the temple and I offer my sacrifice and I'm like, see, I did it. I'm thankful to you, God. It's obvious to everyone, including God, that I might be doing that because as thankful as I am for this past year's crop and harvest, I also want an even better one next year. And I realize that like the best way for me to get on God's good side for next year is to thank him for last year. So this means that a sacrifice can never be 100% sincere. God gives me, so I give God. God gives me. If I don't give God, he's not going to give me.
Just like with gift giving today.
That's exactly right. I mean, the truth is the anthropology of gift giving is exactly right for understanding sacrifices. And exactly right for understanding why child sacrifice breaks that. Because a gift that can't be reciprocated is the only kind of gift that you know is going to be sincere. Now, it's implausible that I'm going to offer a child as a sacrifice in the hopes of having more children later on. That just doesn't make any sense. I'm happy to offer a sheep as a sacrifice in the hope of having more sheep next year. But a child, that seems to be irreplaceable. So there's good religious reason to say, like, this is the ultimate sacrifice. It's the only sacrifice, really, that can be pure in its motivations. So on those religious grounds, like, child sacrifice is attractive. Like, if I want to show just how sincere I am, there's actually nothing comparable to child sacrifice. I'm not advocating it. This is like hard to even say. But it really is attractive for that reason. And then I think the Akedah is basically like, yeah, like, I get that. The first half of the story is like, go offer your son as a sacrifice. This is important stuff. Like, I don't know whether you're really devoted to God or not, because up to now, I've never asked you to offer the single most important thing in your life. But now you have a son. The son is your heir. Offer me that heir. Let's see if you're willing to do that. If so, then sure, you really are devoted to God. But there is a second half, and that I think is sort of underappreciated in a lot of people who think about the story. The second half says, now don't do it anymore. Like, just stop. And that's not trivial. It's not just like, oh, well, okay, whatever. I mean, you've already shown it, so like we can dispense with the actual bloodshed. You know, my reading, that's the second divine command that's actually philosophically even more important, because what I think is going on in the story is that God is saying, as much as child sacrifice makes sense, I am here repudiating it. And I'll tell you why I don't want it. There's an even more important value that it runs up against. And that's the independent value of Isaac as a human being.
Just to close out, I laid out this parallel universe hypothetical question that you answered beautifully. Different hypothetical universe, there is no Isaac and Abraham story. There is no Akedah. What would be lost? Why is it important for us to have this story at all? What should we be holding within ourselves as we approach it this year and moving forward?
So I find stories to be very powerful. I think, you know, as kids we know this, and then as adults, we engage in fiction, but I think about storytelling as less central in our lives. But stories are actually incredibly powerful ways of thinking through things without having to offer a philosophical conclusion. So we struggle with things. Stories can be complicated in a way that like a Dvar Torah or like a little homily or like a little point that I might want to make about an issue tends to like require simplicity. A story can like leave things open-ended. So this particular story, to some extent, I think we might be free from some of the religious thinking that I think is actually quite pernicious in our world that legitimates submission of ethics to religion. There might be actual benefit if the story didn't exist. But on my reading of the story also actually comes to the climax of teaching that child sacrifice is off the table. Look, that's trivial for us, right? None of us are offering sheep, much less children. So like, we don't need to teach that child sacrifice is forbidden. we do need to think about why child sacrifice is forbidden. The full humanness of every other person that we encounter, like the fact that they are absolutely equivalent to us in terms of their value as human beings, is what I think the Akedah comes down to. Abraham can't sacrifice Isaac because Isaac is his own person. It doesn't make any sense for Abraham to achieve his own piety through the murder of another human being. And that's somewhat trite, but actually, like, if we took that to heart, I think the world would be like a totally different place. If we like profoundly absorb the idea that every other one of the 7.6 billion people has all of the hopes and dreams and spiritual standing and moral value that I have, and of course I know that I have that, but if they also have that, then like suddenly everything's different. So the Akedah is a way of thinking through these things. I think, I don't want to boil down to philosophy because I think stories are impoverished when you translate them into philosophy. I think the power of the story comes from being a story, but I think it can allow us to think through these issues in a way that's quite powerful morally and ethically for our world.
Thank you so much, Aaron, for joining us. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Well, I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for the time.
And thank you so much to all of you out there for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this episode, and we hope that you'll tune in again in the future. We want to remind you, like Dan mentioned at the top of the episode, that we have our Akedah Project website that we worked on with Aaron and with people from a variety of other organizations. And we think it's pretty cool. There's a lot of past guests from Judaism Unbound on there that you've heard from in the past and who are giving their takes on this Binding of Isaac narrative. And there are also some folks who are not as familiar to our listeners, but who bring really cool perspectives that we think could have a positive impact on your experience of these high holidays, opening up the story of the Binding of Isaac a little bit deeper for you. So go to akedahproject.com, akedahproject.com. Lastly, we want to close out this episode in the same way that we always do by encouraging you to be in touch with us. And there are a wide variety of ways for you to do that. There's our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. There's our Twitter feed, also Judaism Unbound. Our Instagram, also Judaism Unbound. There's our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. We also would encourage you, as we close out this year and turn to the next one, if you are able to set aside a financial donation for us, we of course deeply appreciate that. And you can send us either a monthly recurring gift or a one-time gift at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thank you so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.